Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Andy Murray, and you're listening to The Tennis Podcast.
We are back in our spiritual home. It is the Putney Exchange Centre. It is me, David Law. It is, hello,
Catherine Whittaker.
Hello.
Hello. With your kiddies lunch pack that you've brought with you.
I didn't know it was a kid's snack box when I bought it.
No, but it's got a cheese board all of its own.
I really feel like mini cheddars should be available and marketed to children and adults alike.
Yeah, and we brought Grad Matt with us. Grad Matt, hello.
Speaking of children.
Yes. Somebody half my age is in the vicinity. And we are the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph. We have so much tennis to talk about because we have not really been with you for the last couple of weeks. Of course, we had our questions special that was recorded in the dead of the night after the men's singles final that Novak Djokovic won in Melbourne. You might have been able to tell. Sentences were not being strung together with their normal fluidity. And then we had our special from the Fed Cup with Laura Robson and Claire Balding and Joe Jury and all that jazz. But we are now back together. So, folks, where to start? I think where to start is with the current world number one and her coaching situation. We're going to get on to all the results and all that kind of thing. There's so much happened. We'll go over the Fed Cup as well. But it is, I know it's a few days old now, the fact that Naomi Osaka is no longer working with Sasha Bajin. But the fact is, it's pretty extraordinary the way it's happened, and also the words that we've just heard that Naomi Osaka has been using to describe the fact that they've separated. She's over in Dubai at the moment. I think the gist of what she was saying is that she had to get through the Australian Open, which is pretty remarkable, isn't it, to consider that she won the Australian Open when she was she had a coach that she just didn't really feel that comfortable around.
Yeah, I mean, she referenced the sort of first feelings or manifestations of the feelings being in Charleston last year. When she lost in Charleston, she came off the court and she talked about kind of feeling down, didn't she? And she now back references that as a symptom of her, or at least partly a symptom of her dissatisfaction with that relationship, with that arrangement, which is extraordinary, given that she's won two Grand Slams and risen to world number one in the meantime. When the initial story broke with a tweet from Naomi Osaka, it was not a warm tweet. It was all about what wasn't said. She didn't say anything controversial, but it was even less warm than the Djokovic-Agassi split tweet, and that's saying something. And then obviously there's kind of been a void until she's rocked up in Dubai this week. She's done a round table. She's given some quite interesting quotes, particularly to Courtney Nguyen for the WTA and Reem Abalil as well, Sport 360. I still think there's a lot of interest in what's not being said. There's definitely big pregnant gaps there in what she's not saying, but she's saying she wasn't happy, and she puts her happiness and her mental health ahead of her success on the court, and she's confident enough to say, he's not the reason for my success. She's not slagging him off and saying he had nothing to do with it, it was all a disaster. you know, you were all deceived by the whole thing. She's just saying, I'm the world number one. Thanks for everything you've done. It's not worth me being on. You don't make enough of a contribution to my success for me to want to be unhappy for it. And she says she's looking for another coach. She's a Japanese player whose name I hadn't heard of, this an ex-player this week in Dubai, but she said that that's a stand-in sort of role, just so she's got someone there with her in what must be a very turbulent kind of a week for her.
On the face of things, it looks like madness. She's been with this guy for a year. She's won Indian Wells. She's won two Grand Slam singles titles, and she's become world number one. What's not to like about those results is what people might look at regarding that split. Again, as you say, we don't actually know if there's a sort of an incident or a series of incidents that have gone on between them. I actually think we've heard more about it than I would normally expect to hear about a coaching split, because she has, in her actual interviews, as you say, in Dubai, really been quite forthright and quite open, or at least detailed, at how much she's not telling us. We have no idea. But you use the words mental health. I think that's so interesting that a player... We so often see a player just follow, don't we? A player just get told what to do by a coach or a parent, do it, win, and just don't question anything else in their lives except that. And she's actually showing...
Yeah, correlation isn't causation, is it?
There's a lot more to her life than tennis.
Yeah, and that she had the potential to be a world number one and two-time Grand Slam champion before Sacha Bayen was ever a part of her life. And yeah, I mean, without knowing the full story, and we genuinely don't, do we? I don't know anybody that does. Obviously, there's plenty of off-the-record speculation, but I really don't know of anybody that knows what went on. So without knowing that, the word that strikes me is discomfort. She seems to have been uncomfortable with him for whatever reason, and these are people that you, I mean, the relationship between a coach and a player is, it can be a really weird, I mean, it's not a normal amount of time to spend with somebody that you're not choosing, you know, you're choosing for reasons. I mean, yes, you have to have a connection with them, but you're not chosen them purely on the basis of how well you gel with them.
I can't think of another thing quite like it. If you think about team sports, a football club or a rugby team employs a coach and employs the players, and here you've got the player who's the boss employing somebody to tell them what to do in order for them to be better. And I mean, it is a weird combination. And it is such a precarious profession, isn't it? I mean, look at Simona Halep. She finishes with Darren Cahill. She has a trial period with Thierry Van Klimpert, who's in Australian Open coaching David Goffin. They split halfway through. He comes on board and coaches her for half a week to sort of get to know one another.
Was it more or less time than the Connors-Sharapova coaching relationship? Because that's my...
Might have been even
that's
less.
The benchmark for...
It
was for longevity.
Never got off the ground. It moved beyond the trial stage.
That
this
was one.
One
match. Where yeah. Sharapova was one match with Connors. And I'd actually forgotten that one, crikey. But I think he's probably put a few quid away, so he's all right. But Thierry Van Klimpert has actually been with several quite high-profile players in Belgium, and Goffin for 5 years. And then he came to Doha. He was in the support team box throughout the week. She reached the final. Her level of play against Elina Svitolina was just awesome, and it was an inspiring match, one of the best matches I've seen all certainly this year, and up there with probably in the top 10 matches I've ever seen.
It was unreal, that
just
match.
Mind-blowingly good.
You and Joe Jury were high-fiving in the commentary box, I believe.
I was looking for other people who I didn't know to high-five.
As you pointed out, Matt, she didn't get Van Klimpert put down onto court at any stage during the week.
And Van Klimput has been very honest with his assessment, saying, I didn't help her this week. You know, she reached the final because of her own qualities, you know, her own merit. And
isn't that nice to hear?
It's really good to just be honest about it and say, look, this isn't a relationship that's going to work. He said he prefers working with younger players, he said, and sort of developing them. But, you know, Halep's been world number one. She's in a completely different position to other people that he's worked with in the past, and that isn't something that's going to work. So why go down that route? Just put an end to it already.
For me, I see, on the basis of absolutely no personal knowledge of Simona Halep, other than having interviewed her a few times and, you know, seen what we've all seen, I believe that Simona Halep is on a journey to realising she can do this on her own. It's all about self-realisation, self-fulfilment, all of those sitting around the Joshua Tree type words. I think it's about her realising she might choose to bring somebody on. I don't think she's going to spend the rest of her career without a coach, but I think it's she's going through a process of realising, hey, actually, I don't need somebody there necessarily.
Well, something Darren Cahill said maybe a year ago or 18 months ago was that he thinks that you have probably 4 or 5 years with a player when you just deposit all of your knowledge. You give them everything you've got and they probably don't need you after that. And that's, I mean, she didn't have quite that long with him, but she definitely was saying in the interview she gave with Courtney the other day that I want to just think about what all those things that we learnt together and that he told me over the period of time. And I think you're right. I could definitely see, whereas Osaka has said she plans to get a coach in place before Indian Wells, Halep, you get the sense, is going to just see how this goes a little now. And I could see her doing it. I could even see her having a period of time without a coach and then Cahill coming back.
Yeah. I mean, that relationship is by no means, you know, over, done and dusted. We're not talking anymore. I get the impression Cahill's probably texting her on the sly, coaching all the time.
And that must be a little bit difficult for a new coach coming in. Knowing that
you're
relationship
still
is still
your ex,
there.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But just to say on Osaka, I think clearly there's been some kind of personal breakdown in their relationship, but equally we probably shouldn't be as surprised as we are when these relationships with coaches end after a period of success, because we keep seeing it. This stat that's been sort of banded around this week is that the reigning Grand Slam champions on the women's tour are no longer with their coaches. You know, Kerber stick with Fissette, Halep's no longer with Cahill, and now Osaka and Bayin. Go back a little bit further, Stan Stevens and Kamal Murray. Now, they've all got their own individual reasons, but there is a trend there of sort of reaching the top of the mountain, and then where do you go from that? Where, you know, resetting the goals is a difficult thing, and sometimes fresh ideas and a new coach might be a way forward.
It's like, you know, Novak Djokovic did that. He reached the top of the mountain, shed everybody around him, realised that wasn't the answer and went back. But maybe he just needed to go, well, probably did just need to go through that, you know, upheaval process. To had he just carried on with Marijn Vida and his team, he probably or might not now be achieving the results that he is. It's because he went through the woods that he's come out the other side.
Do you think that players have coaches because that's what you do when they get to a certain level?
I think there's
level.
Some of that.
I mean, I definitely feel like that's happened with the super coach mentality. I think that that's part of the reason Djokovic was so excited and wooed by the idea of Agassi, is because that's what you do. You know, he'd obviously done it with Becker. That had worked.
And the idea of having somebody in your box that you want to impress, you know. Yeah. When Federer brought on Stefan Edberg, I think it was because he was not struggling for motivation, but struggling for sparkle, maybe, and having his childhood hero in his box and wanting to impress him, that
gave
was significant.
That.
It wasn't just a big name for the sake of, or everyone's getting big names. That was a really specific kind of.
If you could have anybody to coach you at tennis, who would you have?
Oh.
Who would I have? Oh.
Mary Carrillo.
Right, Mary. Any chance that, you know, Catherine's looking?
She's ever considered it.
She'd be a hell of a coach, wouldn't she? She should just basically be all of our life coaches.
Yeah.
And yeah,
wonder if she's ever considered it, though.
Okay,
answers
right.
on a postcard, Mary.
Let us know, Mary.
Who would you have, Matt?
I mean, he's not available yet, but Andy Murray would be good, wouldn't
I'll
he?
I'll have Magnus Norman. He's the best coach in the world.
Shout.
Isn't he? Come on, what a coach.
Discuss.
Magnus Norman. Right, what else have we got to talk about? Let's go from current time backwards. What happened last week? One thing that happened was that Riley Opelka won his first title. And he's 6'11", although apparently closer to 7 foot. And he...
It's the 7 foot arms race,
yeah.
isn't it?
He beat in the semis, he beat John Isner 6'7", 7'6", 7'6", including a 16-14 tie break. And there were 81 aces. And John
Isner...
Is that
Isner, why no one showed up to watch?
Catherine there, blunt as ever.
Come on.
Not you, that
how
many
much,
people
if I,
turned
what,
up.
What money, if I told you... If I gave a crystal ball and I said, this is the match that this is going to be, which we all had because we knew that that was the match that was going to be, how much money would you have paid for a ticket? English pounds, bearing in mind David's forgotten his wallet today and money is of extra value.
At a premium. I have forgotten my wallet. Catherine's bought me a very nice big coffee to see me through the day. That's the sort of spirit we have here on the Tennis Podcast.
How much money, David? Pounds and pence.
Going back to my coins of the Australian Open. See, I get in free these days, so I find it hard to... No, look.
What a dodge that is.
The better way to put it is the thing with those sort of matches, I would sit through them for sort of freak value. And that's kind of just the how silly
freak
can
value,
it get?
Ladies and gentlemen.
I don't mean to be. And look, I'm a freak. Everybody knows it if they look at me. And I'm not talking about their height. I'm talking about the absurdity of how silly it might get, scoreboard wise. That's because there's not an awful lot to get your teeth into. I always remember back in the day, Pete Sampras played Guy Forget in the final of Queens in 1995, and I remember. The presenter, I think it was John Inverdell on Five Live at the time, saying to Tom Gullickson, I think it was, who was the pundit, how do we get enthused by this? Because there are no rallies. And he said, well, you just have to enjoy the quality of the serving. And unfortunately, that wasn't enough. And that's one of the reasons why they slowed the sport down.
How long did you enjoy the freak value for in Anderson v Isner at Wimbledon last year?
Well, that's the thing. It wasn't enjoyable tennis by the end. It was just get over the line somehow, somebody,
well,
you know?
This is what I kind of think of like an Isner rule. Like, moments of Isner matches are
brilliant
and intensely interesting, but normally they're tie breaks because you've got a bit of jeopardy. Suddenly, you can win the odd point. I mean, I can't against the Isner serve, but players can, and therefore you get tense moments in tie breaks. So, you know... I would watch the Isner-Opelka tiebreaks. They'd be great. There'd be,
yeah.
be
well,
all
it.
Sorts of intrigue. And
16-14, he saved six match points for Opelka.
You know, and that is great, but it's the journey to get there which you have to kind of endure. And it's the same with the final, in a way, with Opelka. I tuned in for literally the last 20 minutes.
Who's this guy he beat?
It's Braden Schnurr, who is... I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Sounded great. I have no idea what he sounded...
from Canada.
Correctly.
He doesn't bounce the ball when he serves.
Like, oh, I'm like all
a,
for that.
Like a Thomas Enqvist.
Thomas Enqvist didn't bounce the ball?
No.
I thought he did one.
No, he didn't. I was looking this up, and
I need
he
to look
didn't
this
bounce
up.
The ball.
How old were you when Thomas Enqvist reached the Australian Open final, Matt? 1999, wasn't it?
I was 2.5.
Oh, can we just end this?
But with YouTube,
you've
confirm.
Got a better memory of Thomas Enqvist than we have. This is depressing.
What bothers me is I spent 15 years watching the entirety of Thomas Enqvist's career, and I was not aware that
he spent about 8 years watching him play on the Champions Tour.
And I didn't even know that he didn't bounce the ball.
Anyway. This Braden Schnurr is actually the second week in a row that a guy without an ATP win has reached an ATP final, because in Cordoba 2 weeks ago, a guy called Juan Ignacio Londero reached the final and then won the tournament, and this Schnurr reached the final in New York and then lost to Opelka.
Have you got any... what's the other chap's name?
Juan Ignacio Londero.
Have you got any Londero quick facts?
No. Well, I just gave you one. He won in Cordoba.
Yeah.
Okay. No. He bounced the ball, what, four times?
Yeah, possibly.
Right. Okay.
Infinitely more than Schnurr.
Was he Argentine?
Mm.
Yeah. Schnurr. Because I felt for Cordoba that Del Potro didn't play.
Mm.
So I'm pleased that they had Argentine success.
Okay. Can we just give a quick note of appreciation to John Isner for getting 92% yeah. first serves in a tennis match? How did you do that?
That's the equivalently brilliant stat to that terrible stat of Tatiana Maria with her 7%
first serve.
An entire match when you only miss your first serve four times.
It's absurd.
And in the match against Opelka, he got 88% in, and he still lost.
Opelka served 86 aces in his last two matches.
And I believe Opelka is a tiny bit taller than him,
yes.
Or at least claims to be. Oh, that must be annoying.
He's the first 7-foot player, and
he feels like he's finally fended off Ivo Karlovic, who I know isn't officially retired, but he's a fading force.
A lot of people think that Opelka really could do something in the sport. You know,
he could serve.
Well, he can, but win big. Have you read that? I mean, he's 21 years of age. I think he's had some injury issues the last couple of years. I mean, literally getting used to that body and putting it through the rigors of professional tennis when you're a teenager, I think that's a real challenge for him.
Doing all the flying.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Oh.
It just rip all the other seats out.
Yeah.
But the fact that he has won this title at 21 and... There are people, like Brad Gilbert has said it for a couple of years now, that he thinks of all of them, he's the one. And Andy Roddick said on social media the day, he's good. He's
of all really of good. The young Americans, as yeah. in of all of Tommy Paul and Taylor Fritz
yeah.
and...
TFO?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, I know Patrick McEnroe has rated TFO as the highest of them all for a while now, but Opelka just... What do you do? If that guy is serving yeah. well...
Mm. I mean, we've said that about John Isner for 10 years and...
Isn't it going to be interesting, though, when Opelka... See, this is where I look at the big servers. Yes, when they come up against each other, it's a tough watch.
Yeah.
But I've always enjoyed watching Miloš Raonic against Andy Murray,
for instance. Contrast of styles. I'm talking about is two playing one another, just as there are other contrasts of style. There are other star matches that just don't work.
I remember when Karlovic was serving ace after ace, and then I think it was about 08, he played Federer at Wimbledon and about third round, and Karlovic hadn't been broken all the way through the tournament, and in the first game he was broken by Federer, and it was just watching this genius trying to decode the serve and blunt it was fantastic. So yeah, we got about 15 years of that to look forward to. So well done, Riley Opelka. Who else has won stuff this week? We've had Elise Mertens, who we must mention, who had had a terrible year up until now. She'd only won, I think, two matches all year. She'd lost third round of the Australian Open. She'd lost first round in the other Australian event she played. She'd lost both of her Fed Cup matches.
That was the one for me, the week before.
Yeah. Against France. She lost at home.
Yeah.
Both of her Fed Cup singles matches. And then just suddenly got on a roll. She'd lost no sets at all in the... in the route through to the semi-finals, ended up playing Kerber, won that in three, and then she overhauled Halep from 6-3 2 love down, and Halep had just won 18 points in a row.
I've never seen Mertens play that well. No Australian Open semi-finals last year, but I was really blown away by Elise Mertens. The strength of it, the timing. I know you don't think of her as a power player, and that's, I think, partly because of what she looks like. Actually, if you close your eyes and don't look at her sort of stature, she actually gives the ball a good pelt because her timing's so good.
The timing is the thing, because she's not giving these agricultural swings. But the ball is pinging off the racket.
She can change direction on the ball so, but you don't know where it's going.
Mm.
So impressed with how she turned it around against Halep, who looked to be just a woman on a total mission after that win over Svitolina. It seemed just sort of destined. It seemed like, okay, you've got over the big hurdle. Now it's not a formality. That's unfair to Mertens, but hers to lose. certainly.
And actually, those are two pretty significant mental triumphs, I would say, both for Halep over Svitolina, who gave that wonderful quote afterwards that I decided I was never going to give up against this player again, because she admitted she had done twice in Rome and was 2-4 down in the heads against Svitolina. And in the match itself, she was 1-4 down, and I mentioned it earlier, just if you get a chance to watch this match again, just try to suspend your knowledge of what happens, because I can't think of a more uplifting tennis match than what I witnessed for those three sets.
Yeah, and Halep, it's possible she ran out of steam a little in the final. She had a lot of exertion in the Fed Cup, didn't she? I mean, Simona Halep, PS, really wants to win the Fed Cup. I only saw sort of points here and there and some gifs of Simona Halep in her Fed Cup matches, but there was a look in her eye, my goodness.
I mean, she leapt over the team bench to go and congratulate the doubles when they'd won. You know, it was fantastic.
Someone
to see
tweeted,
that passion
Fed
for Fed Cup.
Simona Halep is coming for you, and that's how it felt.
She beat Pliskova.
Yeah.
And then she beat Siniakova, didn't she?
Mm.
Yeah, so that they were without Kvitova, weren't they?
I
think the Czechs. But still, beating the Czech Republic 3-2 in the Czech Republic.
They hadn't lost at home for 10 years, Ooh. Czech Republic. They hadn't lost in the Fed Cup on home soil for a decade. And
wow.
And it went to the deciding doubles, and it was Siniakova and Krejcikova, the Wimbledon Roland Garros champions from last year. And so you're thinking, well, you know, your money's on them, but Niculescu and Begu, wasn't it? Managed to upset
David
them from
Law
a set down.
Of women's tennis.
Monica Niculescu.
That's what they call her now, David.
Yeah, that's right.
Don't you proud?
I was impressed.
Wonder how she gets on against Solly Hall Simon.
I was impressed.
What'd you do, Monica? Help me out.
Sorry. I imagine the ice would be slice and dice.
Yeah.
And win.
I've tried that. It doesn't work.
But it was impressive for Halep, after the physical and emotional exertion of a Fed Cup week, to fly all the way to Doha and really, you know, reach the final. The thing about Mertens, as you said, you know, you saw a more impressive level of tennis from her this week than ever, and she basically said that as well. She values this title more than reaching an Australian Open semi-final, because she beat three top 10 players in a row, Mertens, Kerber and Halep. And
those are huge wins. Huge.
Talking of massive uplifting sights on a tennis court, we saw a few of those in Rotterdam.
Talking about Denis Shapovalov rapping.
Well, that was a particular moment.
Did you find that massive and uplifting?
I need to watch it again just to
really, really hone in on the lyrics.
Fully formulate my view on the subject.
Available on the internet, folks.
Yep, the internet producers again. And so I will be going to watch that after this podcast. He actually had a decent week. He got to the semi-finals, didn't he? And I think he got a win over Thomas Burdick along the way. But really, the tournament
lost to Wawrinka in the quarters.
Yes, you're right.
Yeah.
Quarters. It's memorable, that tournament, obviously for Gael Monfils winning it and doing an amazing job at it. But I almost feel like I'm going to remember it more for Stan Wawrinka. His shot making, the joy that he brings, certainly to me when I watch him, and the effect he has on tennis crowds, the combination of the gall that he has to go for some of the shots that he goes for
makes you gasp, doesn't
and
he?
And the fact that he can pull them off with this flourish, and then he unleashes that roar. He's started roaring before the crowd know it's a winner, hasn't he? And it just goes right through you. It gives me goosebumps watching him. And considering where he was a year ago, I remember attending his first press conference in Australia ahead of his comeback, and he just decided to come back in Australia because, I've got to start somewhere. And his knee, when you looked at him, he looked like he was on somebody else's legs. They didn't seem to really belong to him.
He lost to Tennis Sangren, didn't he?
Yeah, and it was really, I felt, I mean, it wasn't as hard as watching Andy Murray, but it was going towards that. I thought we were looking at a finished
several
play,
months after that, I sat courtside to watch him play Andy Murray at Eastbourne, and that was, you know, Murray ended up losing to Kyle Edmund the next round in what I found a really depressing match from an Andy Murray perspective. And I know Stan on grass has never looked quite right, But the fact that he lost to Andy Murray in two, I think it was two pretty convincing straight sets. He was in a, I mean, that was late June of last year. He was in a bad way then, a really bad way. And I thought, I looked at both of them and I thought, and they were playing these rallies, and there was almost this smile on both of these face, both of their, but they, it was something more than the respect and warmth of two players that have been through injuries, two players that have sort of, they have so many things in common, you know, the fact they've muscled into the big three, etc. But there was this look on both of their eyes of, the person who wins this match is going to be the one that's least crook, you know, we are both shot here. That's what I saw in them. So to see Wawrinka, I'm not going to say vintage, but I never thought he'd be anywhere close to what I saw in Rotterdam this week.
He looked like
anywhere
himself,
close.
Didn't he? He looked like himself.
Yeah, well, and the wins that he got back that up.
Who did Wawrinka beat again?
So he beat Pear, Raonic, avenging that defeat that he had against him at the Australian Open, which I must say I thought was one of the underrated, most brilliant matches of that tournament. And the first first glimpse of Wawrinka showing the kind of form that he had, you know, two or three years ago. And then he beat Shapovalov, as we've mentioned, and Kei Nishikori, who...
Oh, I saw quite a bit of that. It was like a throwback, wasn't it? I mean, because we've seen quite a bit of this generation that kind of, I don't know, nobody quite knows how to pigeonhole that generation of Dimitrov and Raonic. Wawrinka doesn't deserve to be in that because he's done so much more than those other players.
He's also older.
Well, he is. But I do love the way these older players are just refusing to go away. And it struck me when he was playing Monfils in the final that you've got two guys there, they don't need to be playing tennis. They're doing it because they still believe they've got more to offer and because, well, they must love it. And I found that really just heartwarming, to be honest. I loved watching those two play.
And the thing about Wawrinka is, if he can keep this level up and maybe go up even a couple more notches, he is going to be a really significant player this year, because if there's one guy who can trouble Novak Djokovic in a Grand Slam, it's Stan Wawrinka. You know, we've seen that.
Certainly in Paris.
He's a complete...
Wow.
He's two finals he's beaten him in. Is it two out of two?
Well, he beat him in New York and Paris.
Wow.
And then he also got him once in the quarterfinals of Australian Open. And he can be a complete wrecking ball to anyone's game in any draw. And
he has that ability to be a wrecking ball, but also to keep it up over best of five sets.
Exactly.
There are other wrecking balls out there, but not any that you'd trust to do it best of five.
That's why they call him Diesel, isn't
it?
Yeah.
Federer comes up with all the best Stan Wawrinka nicknames, doesn't he? Stanimal and Diesel. It's not fair to talk about the event without talking about the bloke who won, because Gael Monfils is probably certainly one of maybe the top five most frustrating talents that tennis has had in the last 20 years or so, because I've certainly felt at times that we're going to see more from him, that he's going to break through. I remember when he played Nadal in the final of Monte Carlo and he'd beaten Dimitrov and Federer to get there, and he looked like he was just going after his shots in a way that he's never done before or since. And I still feel a little shortchanged by his career. But when we're talking about Naomi Osaka and mental health, I think that, and I don't know Monfils, but I just get the sense that he's another case study of somebody. It's not fair to just have a one-size-fits-all approach to assessing. I think there's a lot more that goes on with him. I think there's a lot more that goes on with every player. And, well, I'm just pleased that he's got another great title on his CV, and hopefully he will do more.
Yeah, I mean, I went through a period after that year when he teamed up with Michael Thielstrom and reached the US Open semi-finals. That was the most significant result, sort of culmination of their time together for me. I really thought Monfils is finally happening. You know, there was definitely something about that relationship that worked, and he obviously said, "We're going for this now. Like, this is it. This is, we are going to whatever." whatever it means, we are going to fulfill your talent. And then, and it was all going really well, and then that semi-final happened, and it was just so weird and awful.
Djokovic in that year that Wawrinka beat.
Yeah, 2016.
Yes, 2016, and it was a 6-love first set, and he came out. He came out not believing he. I thought he had watched the Simon.
Earlier
match,
that year.
From the Australian Open earlier that year, when Simon took the seemingly completely the unassailable Djokovic. This was Djokovic that where it was a headline for him to drop a set. Simon took him to five by completely slowballing him and giving him junk, basically. And Monfils, who I know he has a lot of variety in his game, but that US Open in that year with Thielstrom, he wasn't playing that way most of the time. He was playing proper tennis. He was believing in himself. Not proper tennis, but you know what I mean. He was playing the tennis that he's most capable of, the most effective tennis for him. And then he got into that match and stepped out on the court and just thought, oh, I'm not good enough. I'm going to just do weird things and stand 8 metres behind the baseline. And everyone just went, oh. And I felt a little bit depressed at times watching Monfils since then, because I've just thought, I've really believed in you and you don't believe in yourself, and that's sad. And I don't know, I've just felt this sort of icky feeling of I believe you want it somewhere in there, I want it for you, but it's just not going to happen.
But I think what he believes he wants is not necessarily the same as we assume that all tennis players want. I think there's some of this in Nick Kyrgios. I don't think that they define their success or failure in terms of just sheer titles alone.
And I'm completely fine with that.
You know, I think
I don't think lumping him in with Nick Kyrgios is fair. I think Nick Kyrgios wants it an awful lot more than he tells us.
But wouldn't he work harder if he did? Wouldn't he?
Oh, we've been through this. I think he's afraid to admit to himself how much he cares.
Yeah, but I think
if he works harder, then he'll be.
I think what they share.
He'll be
in
really failing. If you don't try, you can't fail.
I know what you mean, but it's our definition of what's success and failure. We're putting that on them, aren't we? I think that what they share in common is a love of moments, of experiences, of making the crowd get up on the feet and go, "How on earth have you just done that?" The buzz, and whilst historically that is an underwhelming thing to take with you because you can't put that in the record books, I think that's maybe what gets them going.
Well, it's Monfils is kind of, he's been a highlight reel player, hasn't
yeah,
he? He's
there
been
you go.
He's been.
It took me 10 minutes to say that.
he takes joy from it, and that's kind of the only, this sounds blunt and maybe a bit cruel, but that's kind of the only joy you can take from Monfils' career, because he's had these moments, but you've also had to talk about him with sort of modal verbs and could have, should have, might. He's never fulfilled.
Modal verbs.
He's never fulfilled anything that he's promised. You know, this is his 8th career title. I mean, that just isn't many for a guy. This is technically his biggest title. I think he won Washington, was a 500.
Yeah.
This is a 500. So, you know, in terms of pure sort
this
of
this was a
points,
guy that won in the year that Andy Murray won the US Open Juniors, he won the other three Junior Slams.
But I think, so if you take all that away, you can just enjoy Monfils as a tennis player, but he's frustrating because you want him to do more, and I find it very difficult to watch Monfils without that sense of frustration. I try and not let it creep in. I try and just enjoy the moment.
There are people that are quite happy to just enjoy the
show. There are.
Some tennis fans, and I actually think probably maybe even the casual occasional tennis fan is particularly quite happy to just say, you know what, I don't care about how many slams he's won. I want those moments.
But it's the same with Nick Kyrgios, isn't it? You've got to get to the moments. You can't just show up for the moments. You usually have to win through three grinding rounds against Guido Pella to get to the big moments.
Well, there's no question that Kyrgios has really been disappointing the last year or so. No question about it.
But I don't want to hop back on that US Open semi-final too much, but it really it was such a seminal Monfils moment for me, because I had accepted him as a showreel, big, a moment player, And he didn't go out there thinking, I'm going to do a moment here. I might lose, but this is going to be swashbuckling.
Well, I felt the
this
same.
This is going to be a game on Fieske.
That
out.
Monte Carlo final I referenced ahead of that, I had that same sensation having seen him beat Federer and just knock him off the court. And it felt like he was ready to impose himself on everybody. And I really, I'd been won over by him in that week. And we never really saw it again. By the way, Catherine, we've been in this Putney exchange probably about 4 years. Nobody's ever said modal verbs, have they?
That's my language degree coming out.
Yeah.
Sorry. But the other thing about Monfils is I actually picked Svitolina to win in Doha because I thought she was in a really good place off court and just playing good tennis.
Yeah, they've got their own Instagram account.
But that also applies to Monfils. He does seem to be in quite a good place. He was a lot more focused, a lot more intense on the court. I know we have seen this before, but if he's in a good place at the moment, you know, his tennis can follow. But it just, I don't want to get too carried away about this week for Monfils. It's great as a achievement on its own, but I think it's difficult to talk about the big picture because we have seen these things before. I'm not sure he's necessarily changed this week.
I'm glad you brought up your failed prediction for Svitolina for Doha, Matt, because that was in our newsletter predictions, of which Catherine went for Angelique Kerber to win
Gems
Doha.
Gems Life, sorry. That's their Instagram, their joint Instagram account, Gems Life.
Right, okay, yeah.
Which I believe is... It's their initials, G, Gail, E, Alina, M, Monfils, S, Svitolina,
yeah.
Life.
Well, it works.
That's what people are doing now.
Is there an apostrophe in there or not?
Isn't it written like friends or something?
Is it?
With the full stops between
that
all the letters or something like that.
That is going to be awkward if they split up. But yeah. Who gets custody of the Instagram account?
You can edit them, though, can't you, those Instagram accounts?
What, right. You're just editing your new partner?
Hope it fits. Should say, Catherine's just been trying to distract us from the newsletter predictions which we made. So Catherine went for
guesses in David's case.
Catherine went for Kerber and Svitolina for Doha. Neither happened.
I went for Kerber. Matt went for Svitolina. I think that's an honourable. We got the two semi-finalists. Let's high five, Matt.
No. You both said that they'd win and they didn't.
At least it was a prediction. We honoured the competition.
Yeah,
I'm not even going to let you say this, David, because it's so. This has annoyed me so much.
I went for great.
I've got to go and have a wisdom tooth taken out in 5 minutes. Don't put me in a bad mood.
Well, let's just down here for another 5 minutes after that, Matt, and then I can get it out. Yeah? I said that Britain would draw Fed Cup at home, and they did.
Literally a toss of the coin. You predicted...
I guess.
You predicted heads or tails for our newsletter.
Which you can sign up to, folks, if you'd like to. Predictions every single week.
Hashtag quality content.
In our newsletter.
I mean, it genuinely mostly is quality content, but that was absolute drivel.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Catherine did get very upset, but I got it right, is what happened. So what else have we got to talk about? Karen Khachanov is having a bit of a bad time at the moment.
4 wins, 4 losses for the year, and he said he's having health issues.
Oh, I hope he's all right, because he seems like a nice bloke.
That sounds to me like, I mean, that doesn't sound injury, does it? It sounds like illness, sounds like, I don't know, it could be anything. Could be, it's not uncommon for players to have mono. Is it the glandular fever? It sounds like something in that direction.
People were saying he'd changed his racket.
He has, yeah. He's,
for a new sponsor, which I remember...
That's not a health issue, David.
No, I understand. It can send you a bit, you know. I remember way back when I went to Miami in about 2000 or 2001, and Marat Safin was at the top of the tree, and he changed rackets, I think from Head to Dunlop at the time, and he was so dissatisfied with the version of the racket that he got given that he was taking his old racket and just painting it the old colours.
Which I believe is not that uncommon.
Or the new colours, rather.
For them to just play with whatever racket they want and have it painted in the style of
this game went south.
And Federer last year, mid-season, started playing with a load of white paint in sort of the middle of their head.
Suspicious.
And then he reverted back to the all-black frame. And as far as I can tell, it's the same racket. It's actually just... sort of when he swings the racket, he sees the white, and against the black he didn't like as much as what he used to prefer with the white against the red.
Djokovic did it as well, didn't he, after he won that first Australian Open?
He changed the head, which is the same move that Hachanov has made.
It's not going well for Head.
No.
Oh well. You can still sponsor us though, folks. It's absolutely fine.
I play with a Head.
Do you?
Yeah, it's right. Going all right. Well, I mean, yeah, it's all relative.
Rematch hasn't happened yet. 5 years on. Matt, what happened in, where was it, Buenos Aires this last week? Was that's the tournament we haven't covered.
That was won by Marco Cecchinato, who's won his third career title. And he's only won 33 matches, and he's got three titles.
He's the last person to beat Djokovic at a Grand Slam.
Indeed.
Who'd have thought I'd have come up with that? Just play
around. Goodness me, a year is a long time in tennis,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Less than a year is a long time in tennis.
And I think this does kind of raise an interesting point about the way these tournaments are scheduled, because Diego Schwartzman, okay, he was playing doubles in Buenos Aires with the guy who likes to play all the time, Dominic Thiem. But Schwartzman, you know, they kind of have those sort of, what is it, split session semi-finals, and Schwartzman was on really late and then had to come back reasonably early the next day.
And he's not one to get jobs done quickly,
no.
Diego Schwartzman, is he?
He was
a lot
cooked
of running
in that final. I mean, Cecchinato is a delight to watch on clay when he's on.
Why?
Because he spreads the court just amazingly with that one-handed backhand. He's obsessed with drop shots. He does too many, but when they work, they're fun.
They're kind of fun either way, though, aren't they? Drop shots are funny.
Yeah.
I love drop shots.
Don't tell Jo Konta that, because it didn't go well for her.
But
even
that
Australia
sort of brain cramp element to drop shots, you can't go wrong.
Andy Murray definitely thinks drop shots are. Do you remember when he kept doing them? Brad Gilbert couldn't conceal his disgust.
He tried to ban them.
Didn't he do them to? Wasn't Gilles Simon injured once in? I want to say it was Monte Carlo or something. And Murray just kept drop shotting him, and the crowd were just sort of doing that French hiss that they do.
Brad Gilbert tried to ban drop shots the way he actually banned Andy Roddick from wearing a visor.
I remember that.
On the subject of Gilles Simon, we must mention Daniil Medvedev.
Yeah.
Because he's the other bloke who Tamani Karyol mentioned on Twitter the other day that it was one of the moments of the year that Medvedev actually tried to beat Djokovic at his own game and outlast him at the Australian Open. And I remember I was courtside commentating on that, and that's exactly what he was trying to do. And for a set, well, 2.5 sets, he did it. It was just so interesting to watch, and then to watch him wither physically and be unable to handle it anymore.
Can you imagine how giddy when he hits puberty? I've got to go, folks. I thought I'd just leave you with that.
Going to leave us with that little line and go off and have a wisdom tooth out and take her little packed lunch box.
Wish me luck,
with her.
People.
It actually says on the label, "Kids snack box."
It might be my last solid food for days, so yes. I thought I'd go out on a high, okay. A cheese string high.
Hope it goes well, Catherine.
Thanks. Sorry, Daniil. I think you're a fabulous player.
Yeah.
And what I mean, you know, he's got some filling out to do.
Best is yet to come. That's all Catherine's saying.
Well, few of them do.
He kind of looks like a sort of lanky assemblage of shortcomings, doesn't he? He's got to explain yourself.
Why
are you not listening?
Explain yourself. Yeah,
in that he's got slightly weird technique, and he doesn't look like a top tennis player, and yet he's brilliant. He's
what are these shortcomings?
Well, I've just said
he's assembled
his strange technique and the fact that he's not built like a lot of the other
top guys.
There's
nothing wrong with being lanky.
No, absolutely not. I am. but and yet he's kind of cold and he'll just beat you. And
I know what you mean. You do watch him and you think, how are you doing this? How are you winning all these matches against these people who are more powerful, got bigger muscles and are grown-ups?
But yeah, and he's really good. He's deceptively good. But he's weird because he's quite sort of methodical and mechanical, and yet there's this mystery around him. No one quite can understand what makes him so good. Obviously, he's got a big serve, and he's so solid from the baseline. And he was absolutely carving through the draws in Sofia, where he won the title, and he was going, you know, great guns in Rotterdam before Monfils stopped him. So he's barely got any points to defend on the clay. So he is really one whose ranking could rise, and we've been talking about Hachanov as the Russian who is, you know, I still think he will get in the top 10, Hachanov, but Medvedev could also get there as well.
Yeah, yeah, and he also doesn't care what anybody thinks,
no.
Does he?
He's not even a little bit.
He doesn't seem the slightest bit bothered that everybody else talks about Tsitsipas and Shapovalov and all the other players ahead of him and Zverev. He just, yeah, fine, I'll just go out and win stuff. So I think, is there anything else we've forgotten? Anything of great note? A Davis Cup Finals draw was made this week, presented expertly by the now departed Catherine Whittaker.
We left it a bit late to talk about that, really. Yeah.
Well, she did a good job. We know that bit.
She nailed
and
it.
Britain have drawn Netherlands, and they've also drawn in the group stages
Kazakhstan,
which is the same as Britain have drawn in the Fed Cup World Group Playoffs in April. I mean, that is as good as it gets, isn't it? I mean, no offence or disrespect to the Netherlands and Kazakhstan, although I suppose I am giving them disrespect, but that is not a bad draw, is it?
No, it was about as good as it could get, especially when probably the two favourites for the title, Croatia and Spain, have ended up in the same group.
And also, haven't the United States and Canada been drawn in the same group?
That's right, yeah.
Wow.
And France and Serbia, so I mean, if Djokovic plays, and they're with Japan, if Nishikori plays, so really, in terms of world ranking, I think the only team with a lower kind of highest ranked player than Kazakhstan and the Netherlands was Colombia. So really, Britain got one of the best groups they could hope for.
I know it's not popular to say this and uncool at the moment, but I'm quite looking forward to it.
I am.
Nobody wants to hear that for some reason, but, you know, let's see. Let's see what it's like.
We have to give it a chance, don't we? I think there are elements of it which, you know, most people are accepting are probably not ideal, but it could still be a brilliant event.
Yeah, it could. Right then, Grad Matt and myself, David Law, here on the Tennis Podcast. Catherine Whittaker no longer here, but we'll be back next week with another instalment of the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph. We are executive produced by tennisballs.com. Our mascot is Rio with a Y. Listen, folks, make sure you tell people you know about the Tennis Podcast. If you like it, let your mates know, let your Twitter followers know, tell everybody you know, and we'll see if we can grow our audience and keep this going for as long as we possibly can, do as many shows as we can. We've got myself and Matt doing blogs as often as we can. We're doing our weekly newsletter now with our predictions in and goodness knows what else, so make sure you sign up to that, monitor our Twitter account, we'll put our links on there. But for now, that's it from us, and we'll see you next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.